Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David James Gonzalez, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Elisa Eastwood Pulido, author of The Spiritual Evolution of Margarito Bautista, a Mexican Mormon evangelizer, polygamist, dissident, and utopian founder, from 1868 to 1961, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. Elisa Eastwood Pulido holds a PhD in religious studies from Claremont Graduate University. Last year, she returned to CGU's Department of Religion as a visiting scholar. Her areas of research include the Mormonism in Mexico, race and religion in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Her recent book, which we're talking about today, The Spiritual Evolution of Margarito Bautista, again, was released by Oxford University Press in 2020, and she currently lives in Huntington Beach, California, with her daughter. Hello, Elisa, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Well, thank you so much, DJ. I'm really pleased and happy that you invited me to come today. Thank you.
Well, thank you for accepting the invitation. And to get us started today, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Okay, I have come to religious studies sort of later on in life. I got my PhD in 2015 in religious studies. But before that, I had an MFA in writing from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and I had a bachelor's degree in German. So I took this very circuitous route. But I have to say, so I publish a lot of poetry, but I will have to say that my creative writing has helped my academic writing as well. I used to write research poems. Now I'm researching religion, but I'm still concerned with the sound of language, and I try to be really conscious and generous of my readers as I'm writing. So that's where I am today, reading and writing, and mostly a lot on race and religion lately, especially in terms of Mormonism in Mexico.
Yeah, that makes me curious. I mean, that is quite the, as you mentioned, circuitous route, which, you know, and it's not abnormal. I mean, a lot of academics have a you know, less than, I'd say, traditional or standard kind of path into what they do. But I was just wondering, so what was it that caused you to make that switch from being a writer, you know, a poet, and then saying, hey, this religion and race sound pretty interesting?
Well, actually, what I first said to myself was, wow, I think I'd like to go get a PhD in mythology, because that would really fuel my writing, right? All those wonderful legends, etc. But what happened was that I was living in San Juan Capistrano at the time, and I saw that there was a brand new degree, well, a program in, it was a chair. Richard Bushman was coming from Columbia University to Claremont Graduate University for a new program in Mormon studies. So I thought, wow, I'd like to take some classes from him. And who has better founding narratives and stories than religion? That's got to fuel some writing. And I will have to say, it definitely has. I'm probably about 4 projects out right now. So, yeah, it has fueled my writing for sure. And not only that, expanded my view on human experience, on the world. It's been sort of this massive, massive awakening for me.
I love that. I love hearing how people how we get into what we're really interested about. It always reminds me, and I make the analogy, and this is going to date me somewhat, of this old PC game called Minesweeper. I'm not sure if you remember that. It's basically looked like a puzzle box, right? And you would click on these boxes to try to detect where the mine is, and you would click on this one box, and then a whole vast area would open up. Right. So the interest, getting a PhD sounds like fun, right? An interesting project. Let's go do that. Right. And then you just open, you're exposed to this vast world, right? Of all these different pathways and things you could study and examine and learn about. So I love that.
I come also from this family of 5 girls and a boy. They were in my family, and I was experiencing a personal crisis at the time. And my family, it's my parents are both teachers. So you have a problem, go back to school, get another degree. The answer to all of life's problems.
Right?
I have to say, it hasn't earned me enough money, but it sure kept my mind occupied.
We're going to have to talk a lot more after this, because there's a lot of similarities between us. I also come from a family of 4 girls and 1 boy. I'm the only boy among my siblings. And both my parents were educators also. They're both K through mostly primary education. My dad was eventually a elementary school principal. But yeah, I credit that for instilling this kind of mindset in myself, like the moments when I've been lost in my life, or oh my gosh, this career failed me. What am I going to do now? Well, go back to school, learn some more, try again, right?
True.
Great, great. Well, let's talk about the book. This is obviously, a figure even for members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, people known as Mormons, referred to as Mormons or Latter-day Saints, LDS people. This is a figure that very few know about. I'm not a religious historian. I don't talk a lot about it on my channel usually because it's so far from my field, but I'm really intrigued by it. And as someone that himself, my parents, they converted to the church, they joined this church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, when I was a baby. And so I was eventually raised in it. This is a person we never heard about, right? There's if you're Mexican or Mexican American and you grow up in the Mormon Church in the United States, a Mexican or even a Latin American, I'm going to venture to say, is really a leader in the church is something you never hear about, right? So, just tell us, how did you find out? How did you discover Margarito and eventually decide this guy needs a biography and I'm going to do it?
Yeah, he's kind of been thought of as a pariah within Mormon history for a long time. I wrote a paper on the 3rd convention for a class the section was on religion in the borderlands. But the teacher was Gaston Espinosa, and he's written a lot about Latinx spirituality and religiosity. He was fascinated. The 3rd convention was a schismatic movement where 1/3 of the members of the church in Mexico left the church in 1936. They had petitioned the mainstream church in Salt Lake City for a Mexican president of the Mexican mission. They wanted a native president of the mission. And the answer was no, and eventually this group left the church and the leaders were excommunicated. Among the leaders of this group, one of the main figures was Margarita Bautista. Gaston Espinosa was so animated by my paper. He had done a paper on a Pentecostal evangelizer by the name of Francisco Olazabal, who really built a lot of congregations for the Assemblies of God in the borderlands. But eventually what happened is there was tension between the leadership of the Assemblies of God and Francisco Olazabal, because it was over leadership. The Latino Assemblies of God wanted to lead themselves. Eventually what happened was Olazabal ended up splitting off and forming the Latin American Council of Churches in 1923. Professor Espinosa saw suddenly, clearly, so many parallels between Bautista and Olazabal. He recommended I read Rudy Bustos' book. I don't know if you've read it, King, The Religious Vision of Reyes Lopez Tijerina, King Tiger. An amazing book. He also talks about problems with the Methodists in Texas because they felt the gringos were in control. If you just start looking through the entire religious history of Mexico and in the borderlands, and even when Protestant missionaries first came to Mexico, after a while, the Mexican ministers they're ordaining want to have some leadership in the mission. So he understood prior to that. He understood that this is a ubiquitous problem. It's not a Mormon problem. It's not a Pentecostal problem. This is a problem of between ethnicities, right? It's a racial problem between the Latino members or previously colonized members of the church, of any church, and then the people who convert them. They're originally very excited to join and for the new things that they are learning, but then there comes a point where they feel like they've mastered the material and want to be empowered to lead themselves. And this is a point that a lot of Euro-American missionary movements have missed when they have moved into the borderlands and tried to proselytize Mexican and Mexican Americans. This whole history of spiritual colonization rears up in everyone's face. Well, you're excited to learn new things, but of course, they weren't hoping for new overlords. So that is kind of the tension right there. So my parents were actually missionaries in Mexico in 1946 at the reunification of the convention.
Wow, no way.
Yeah, and that's where they met. That's why my name is Elisa. they became Spanish teachers when they came home. Pulido is a name that I share with my three fabulous children. So at any rate, what Gaston told me, he said, look, you are in a position where you have your parents to interview. They know other missionaries who were familiar with the convention, who perhaps met Margarito. And so you are in a unique position because these people are passing away. History doesn't wait for you. You have to do it when you can. And so I decided that he was right. And if he was this excited, a man who is not a Mormon, was this excited about Margarito, who had left thousands of pages of writing. And I have to understand, this almost never happens. I've been to AAR conventions where the way they recover Native convert voices is through missionary records. This didn't have to happen with Margarito because he had 25 years of diaries and a 564-page book and scores of pamphlets and letters and articles. I could go straight to him and hear what he had to say about it. But I found that Professor Espinosa's advice was perfectly right. I interviewed the people I could. In the process of writing my book, they have all since passed, including my own father and mother. So that most of them were in their late 80s or 90s when I began. So, it was an opportunity that wasn't coming back. And that's what got me started. I started going up to Utah then, and I started doing research at the Mexican Mormon History Museum, BYU, and the LDS Church History Archives, University of Utah. I just did a lot of research up there. Then I wrote my dissertation, and my dissertation committee just asked me then, when is your book coming out? So I had to begin writing all over again. And, he's a complex figure. And I kind of waited a while to do it again because he's transnational, bilingual, religiously diverse, etc. So while it is and still, while it was and still is important to look at the details of his life, the few years that it took me to write the book after I graduated gave me the benefit of a greater perspective, just to stand back a little further, take all the details in. I think that was very important and helpful to me.
Definitely. I agree there. And I mean, I'm currently in a similar position with my first book, and I can attest to how much it does help, to put a little distance between, investing all that time and effort in research and writing a dissertation and then making the transition, right, into actually writing a book, a very different thing. For me, my students do provide a ton of help in that. But I also just want to mention appreciate so many of the things that you brought up in describing, the pathway into writing this book. It actually made me think of a saying that Juan Gomez Quiñones, who was one of the founding fathers, if you will, of Chicano history and Chicano studies, professor at UCLA. He was known for saying, write history that matters. And, the response, to your paper, right, first, and then the dissertation, right, it was testament to people saying, you found something. And as you mentioned, this is not just a story that matters for Mormons or Mexican Mormons. The applicability, right, to that challenge, right, of, Christian evangelization, particularly throughout the global South, right? This just has so many parallels, right, and intersections with all of those things and issues and challenges.
Oh, it does. Missionaries tend to go charging in all over the world without understanding the history, the cultural, the political, the religious history of where they have shown up.
Yeah. So the third convention, as you mentioned, which, your parents met at this reunification, right? So this reunification happens in 1947. The third convention is where, there's a split that happens within Mexican Mormon, saints, right? So that's kind of like the hinge point of the book, I think, maybe in many ways. Let's go back a little bit. And can you talk about his spiritual evolution, his early pathway? How does he find Mormonism, right? And what's his, early impact and influence on the Mormon church in Mexico and eventually in Salt Lake, where he moves?
Well, he was investigating Methodism at the time. He was really studying Methodism and thinking that he might become a Methodist. He lived on the slopes of the volcano Popocatépetl in Atlautla. And in this area, you have this kind of passage that runs up between the mountains from Mexico City, was a way for many marketplaces and trading of goods, but also religious movements passed along here. So when the Mormon missionaries came to the area, they're also following these trade routes and the markets. And it was interesting because I found this very fascinating. The Mormon church was, or missionaries were holding meetings. They didn't have a church building. in the same home that the Methodists were holding them in. I guess the Methodists would meet, then the Mormons would meet. So, yeah, he found out about it when they came to his area, or actually one came. It was Ammon Tenney, who probably spent 25 years of his life proselytizing Native Americans and also Mexicans. Spent a lot of years in the saddle, actually. By the time, so he came to teach Bautista. Bautista had a faith healing by Ammon Tenney. He had a terrible case of food poisoning that left him extremely ill for a long time. And finally, he had a faith healing. I've heard a couple of versions of the story, but the way his sister Juana tells it is that her father had thrown Bautista Margarito out of the house for investigating Mormonism. And he was living with a group of young men, and he ate some bad eggs they found somewhere. And this is what made him ill. She says she begged her father to let Margarito have this faith healing. He did have it, and he was healed. I don't think he joined the church immediately thereafter, but he really wanted to attend a conference. And his father, in Cuernavaca, his father didn't want him to go. And the reason his father was pretty set against him becoming a Latter-day Saint was because he was set to become a minister for the Methodists. That's a salaried position, right? You don't have to worry. The Methodists will help you. And instead he chose this religion where they have a lay ministry. There is no payment. And he actually put so much effort, really, into his evangelizing of Mormons throughout his life that he was actually struggling with poverty most of the time, most of his life, because he didn't have a paid position as a minister. But in addition to the faith healing that he had, he says he was very drawn in his narrative about in the improvement era that he wrote of his conversion to the narratives of the Book of Mormon, which say that the native peoples in the Americas are descendants of Abraham, that they're members of the house of Israel. So this gave him this kind of spiritual identity that he really longed for, and it also valorized the Mexican past, Book of Mormon did, by giving him this history of prophets and conscientious objectors and warriors and wonderful, wonderful stories, this history. He wasn't just the descendant of human sacrificing Aztecs, and he was a descendant of a great spiritual figure. So this was very compelling to him. It's very compelling to him that the chosen people in the Americas, the seed of Abraham, were the indigenous, not the Euro-American colonizers, and that things had gone topsy-turvy in the world and were back.
Right, so those two things, right, the kind of this faith healing of sorts that he has, right, but then also the real appeal of some of the theology, or at least the narratives. It's more the narratives within the Book of Mormon, right, or a record of kind of early Christians in the Americas that he finds so appealing, right? Wonderful. And so then he joins the church, right, the Mormon church in Mexico. And what does he begin doing? I mean, he has his gift for preaching. How does he fit this into a church that has a lay ministry?
Well, he gets asked immediately, even before he was baptized by Ammon Tenney, to help with proselytizing. You see, Ammon Tenney didn't have a missionary companion. He had no one to help him, and he he just put the Native investigators and their and newly baptized converts to work. Margarito was called on a, well, he was sent on a few short-term missions thereafter. And so he's just constantly kind of helping the missionaries or preaching the gospel to the Mormon gospel to anyone he could find who will listen to it. He was only, after he was baptized, it took about 2 years and he got married. He was in his early 20s, he got married. But he decided that he wasn't going to learn enough about Mormonism in central Mexico. So he was only there 2 years. And then he went up to the Mormon colonies where he could be near the core leadership of the church. The Mormon colonies are about 1,000 miles north in the Chihuahuan Desert, up in around, well, one of them, Colonia Dublan, is Mandueva Casas Grandes. And then there's Colonia Juarez. So, and Juarez, I think, is what the city's called now. So he went up there to see how Mormonism functioned amongst these Euro-American colonists that Porfirio Diaz had allowed to establish colonies. And he had even told him he would turn his head away from their practice of polygamy. So this is kind of a turning point as well in Bautista's life. I'm sorry to jump ahead like that, but he was only 2 years in central Mexico before he had to head north.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. No, and that's perfect, right? So he heads north, and you're right. He's in these polygamist Mormon colonies. For listeners that don't know, right, Mormons, once the practice of polygamy is essentially outlawed, or they're threatened itself, the centralized church is threatened if they don't outlaw or change the practice of polygamy, right, potentially can have drastic repercussions for the church itself, its property, right? This is the U.S. government. So this is in the 1880s, 1890s, right? So they, you know, on paper, stop the practice, and then those that continue practicing it kind of flee. One of the places they flee to, ironically, is Mexico. This is, for those that know a little bit about Mormon history, they'll realize that Mormons fled to Mexico the first time, right, when they left the Midwest as a result of religious persecution, and they came to Utah. So that happens, right, in 1846. And so here again, they're kind of put in this similar position, right, with the practice of polygamy. And that's how the Mormon colonies in essentially Mexico get started. Is that right? I think there's some of these polygamists also went up to Canada. That's not the subject of the book. But anyway, so that's how these colonies get together, right? And that's how they form. So he spends time there. You mentioned that this is where, you know, he's essentially converted by, you know, someone that lives in these colonies. So I can't remember. It was Tini himself a polygamist? Did he have multiple wives?
Yes, he did. But when he went down to Mexico, central Mexico, on proselytizing visits, he had three wives, but he only brought one of them with him. And he brought another one with him once, but didn't let her go to any conferences because he didn't want talk among the members. Sort of the agreement between Porfirio Diaz was that they were to practice their polygamy quietly. He let them come. They fled to Mexico so they wouldn't have to abandon their families, right?
Right.
So he let them practice it quietly, but he didn't want it spreading among Mexicans. And I think I wrote in my book that the virtue of any class of Mexicans at the time was measured by the virtue of its women, right? So they weren't interested in having Mexican women become polygamous wives. So, yeah, that was the case there. But, yeah, there were several things that happened. So he stays in a polygamous home when he first arrives. He sees polygamy practiced in the community. He's teaching Spanish to the children of the colonists. And at one point, the head of the church seminary program, that church education system, his name was H.H. Cummings, came down to, well, he delivered a message from the president of the church that they had to write a statement. Even though polygamy had been officially ended by the church, people were still practicing in Mexico, right? So polygamy, the manifesto officially ending polygamy is in 1890. So Margarito Bautista moves there in 1903, but he has to sign a statement that polygamy is a true and eternal principle, something to that order, or he will lose his job teaching English. But he also makes all kinds of connections in the Mormon colonies, which he picks up later. Like he knew Dare LeBaron. He knew Anthony Ivins. He knew a lot of people. But some of these people are budding fundamentalists. Because even though the church stopped polygamy, there's an argument in Mexico about whether or not it's okay to practice. It was just a problem with the law in the United States. And then there are questions about whether or not the church should have stopped polygamy. Were they just cowards? They just bowed to the pressure of the U.S. government. And so there is this budding fundamentalist movement that when Bautista, and I don't know if you want me to move to Salt Lake City yet, well, he moves first to Arizona. So he becomes friends with Dare LeBaron. The LeBaron name is probably familiar to a lot of people. Associated with polygamous colonies and other colonies in northern Mexico. He painted with them and they'd have discussions. But a lot of these people befriended him, gave him work, cared about him. They were his friends. The issues that Bautista had with polygamy were because he came to the Mormon colonies. Those Mexicans who stayed in central Mexico didn't have the same issues that he had. It was
right.
Exposure.
Mm-hmm. And so due to this time, right, in the colonies and the connections he develops there, this kind of paves the way for him to be a sort of kind of golden boy, right? I mean, the ideal type of Mexican convert, if you will, and this facilitates his move throughout the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, as you mentioned, up into Arizona. Eventually, he and his family go up into Salt Lake. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, his kind of just this part where he's, you know, these connections really facilitate his kind of, I hate to use the word advancement, but he really has this exceptional experience for definitely for Mexican migrants, you know, during this period, the 1910s, 20s, 30s, etc., that are coming from Mexico. He doesn't, you know, really follow that pathway, and it's due to these connections, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. It is. Have you ever read Jorge Eber's book, Hispanics in a Mormon Zion? He talks about how some people he thought became Latter-day Saints for the connections. This isn't the case with Bautista. I mean, for him, going to Salt Lake City is like going to Bethlehem and seeing the manger or something, right? He's in the crux of the seat of Mormondom.
Yeah, it's like the Mecca, right?
Right, the Mecca. He's a, you know, next to the temple in Salt Lake City and near the seat of the prophet. He is given a job when he comes, ironically, as a gardener. But, you know, this is his background. His father was a farmer and on Temple Square. But, you know, he also has these ecclesiastical opportunities. He is initiated into esoteric temple rites, and he becomes a temple worker. A lot of people in Salt Lake, they see a Mexican in the temple. They're stunned. They don't know what to think. But it means the gospel is growing around the world. You know, it's a glorious sight. And he becomes this token Mexican, right? And then he gets an opportunity later during the, to go around speaking around Mexico about Mexican politics during the Mexican Revolution. The Mexican Revolution happens while he is first in Arizona and then Salt Lake. He leaves Mexico 1 month before the revolution breaks out. So yeah, he is on this little speaker circuit. And then one of the friends, the fundamentalist friends that he meets in Salt Lake is Nathaniel Baldwin, who's the inventor of air compressed radio receivers and has this million dollar company in Mexico. I mean, not Mexico, Salt Lake City, excuse me. And so he offers Bautista a position on his board. And this was a huge boon. Now, Nathaniel Baldwin is highly invested in the development of what he would call Lamanites, which is what Euro-American Mormons were calling, it's a term from the Book of Mormon, that they were calling the Native peoples of the Americas. So he's highly invested in the development of the Native peoples of the Americas. He thinks that, it's something that has gone on in the United States since its inception, where the feeling was, they could Christianize, if they Christianized Native Americans and gave them property, then they could be citizens and assimilate into society. So they're talking about, he's thinking about assimilating. And it's hard for me to talk about. I'm really sorry. But he thinks that if he helps Bautista and other Native peoples of the Americas, they'll become white. And I'm sure Bautista knows he thinks this because he writes about it in his book, but he doesn't really care. He's really enthralled with the help that he's getting. I think he just kind of feels like, if that's what happens to me, it's a necessary evil. But that is not the focus of his faith. It's not the focus of his religion. It is kind of an idiosyncrasy of some of these early fundamentalists. Are, by and large, very kind to him. I mean, when you think about it, he came up unemployed, but he'd been painting in Arizona as a gardener, and now he's a member of a company for $1 million, on a board of a multi-million-dollar company. So this is this meteoric rise through friendship. And then also he's made the first president. He helps build a Spanish-speaking congregation in Salt Lake City. And that is finally officially recognized as a unit church. It's called the Local Mexican Mission, and he becomes the president of this people. So he's rising in the church. He's rising in a career. He's being recognized as a speaker. He has an article published about his conversion story. These are all steps forward in his life, which eventually come to a crashing halt.
Right. Right. Good. And there's a lot more to the story. I appreciate you, doing the best you can there to summarize it. It was truly fascinating, all these different experiences he has, these opportunities he get. But and there's a little more. But essentially, he reaches kind of the pinnacle, right? I don't know. I guess of his membership by the mid 1930s, he goes back to Mexico. He's sent back to Mexico on a mission, right, by the Mormon Church, particularly
That's
22 to 24. There you go. So 22 to 24, and so he has this position in of prominence, essentially, right? In particularly in his local congregation in Salt Lake, and he has these connections. So this is like his rise. And then what happens, right? What is it that eventually one of the two things that you address in the early part of the book is that you really want to explain. How is it that this kind of superstar, if you will, or a golden boy, Mexican convert is, driven away from the church or leaves the church, right? So what's the tension there? And then he becomes this founder of a, separatist, polygamous utopian society, right? And it's quite the turn, right? Yeah. And really, as you mentioned, that convention is the hinge point of all this, right?
Right. So the first thing that happens when he comes back from his mission in 1924 is that they have assigned a Spanish convert to be the leader of, they've changed the name now, it's the Mexican branch. And they've assigned this Spaniard to be the leader. This causes some problems in the congregation because this is the Mexican branch, right? Why do we have this person of European extraction leading our Mexican branch. A fracas breaks out and it culminates in the removal of all Spanish surnamed leadership from the branch presidency, or at least as branch president for 40 years in that branch.
They wow.
put Euro-Americans in there.
Yeah, 40 years, right? 4-0, right?
4-0.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Talk about the heavy hand.
Yeah. So, in fact, he disappears from the records of the branch. I only know that he was attending a congregation in South Salt Lake City because I saw his name on a piece of letterhead that he wrote a letter to somebody. It was called the Wandamere Ward Genealogical Society. And he was the second counselor. That's the only way I know he was there, because he just disappears. His kids are still there. His sister's still there. He's no longer there. He never has a leadership position again in the church, ever. He's never appointed to another leadership position. He writes his book, and then he moves to Mexico to get it published. He never comes back. And his family never goes down. So there's this family break there in 1935. The minute he's there, he's so busy. You never saw anybody whirling around so much. As you read his diary, he's constantly on the road talking to people in different congregations. And he does get his book published, but the mission president asked the members not to buy it. And they've invested in it. He's in really bad financial straits. The third convention comes about, and they petition Salt Lake, and they are told no. Eventually, the third convention splits from the church, and Margarito is excommunicated. But before he's excommunicated from the church, he's ousted from the third convention because he's decided in Mexico, maybe he's lonely in the absence of his family, but this might be a good time to start building his own polygamous family. And he is surreptitiously wooing the daughters of his friends in the leadership of the third convention. So they oust him. This is really like an apocalyptic year in his life. You know, the failure of his book, his ouster from the third convention, his excommunication from the Mormon Church. And so he is really at a low spot. He loses most of his family, his friends. His father disowns him. It's really a low spot. When he finally starts his colony in 1944, he starts his colony, his sister sells him a piece of land that his father was awarded for service in the Mexican Revolution. She sells it to him cheaply, and he has been proselytizing for about 10 years or so before the colony is officially organized. He starts this colony. And it finally gives him new direction, because what he was always about was the redemption of Mexico. And here in this colony, which he names Colonia Industrial, Nueva Jerusalén. So this colony is a prototype for the New Jerusalem. Mexicans can show the world how it's done. And he firmly believes that Mexicans, being obedient as they can, will bring about Christ's millennial reign and redeem Mexico, save them from centuries of suffering. So he adopts the most stringent, the most strict and difficult practices of early Mormonism, which have now gone by the way in the mainstream church. In his colony, they practice polygamy and communalism in this colony. But it's his project for the remainder of his life.
Right. And with those, with this project, I mean, the two things that kind of are if he has like two North Stars, I mean, purposes, right, as you mentioned, is, I mean, really his push in the Mormon Church and the whole reason of the Third Convention and even the previous two conventions was really this push for indigenous leadership, right? You discuss how he develops early on this indigenous kind of, hermeneutic, right, kind of theology, really buying into the Book of Mormon narrative of chosen people, and just couldn't, deal, right? And so many Mexicans, et cetera, right? This is where the appeal goes beyond the Mormon Church, right? They didn't want the paternalism of, right, Euro-American religious leaders, right? And it's actually against, the Mexican Constitution, right, that we have these foreign clerics. So this is that drive, and that's what the whole basis of the Third Convention is, right? And why he and dozens, I think, of others are excommunicated. You mentioned that like a third of the members of the church, or this is the Mormon Church in Mexico, leave the Mormon Church, and they form kind of like a break off of it, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Third Convention, right? And the reason there is that they wanted to lead, right? They didn't want necessarily to have the kind of paternalistic hand of Euro-American church leaders anymore. But then that second thing that he always held on to was this belief in polygamy, right? And that this was the way to kind of reproduce Mexican society. These two things, right? This...
He was very very much sort of, and maybe he got this from Methodism, but kind of this holiness perfectionism. He was a perfectionist, very rigid. Mm-hmm. And if he thought God asked him to do something, anything, and it would redeem Mexico, Mexico was his true love.
Right.
If God had asked him to do anything, and it was going to save Mexico and elevate Mexicans, he would have done it. And so these were two hard commandments the Euro-Americans couldn't keep, so he thought he'd try it, right?
Right. And his book, I mean, we mentioned that briefly, his book was basically kind of the outline of that plan. I mean, he claimed it was like this was this true history of Mexico, right? He was trying to reveal, using a lot of, right, scriptural references to the Book of Mormon. The audience were, his fellow Mexicans, and he'd really hoped that the book would, sell well, right, in Mexico, and kind of help show a vision that connected, right, the budding Mexican nationalism, right, to, this theology. Like, this is the pathway for us to cast off European domination and seize our true destiny, right?
Oh, yeah. He uses a lot of prophecies from the Book of Mormon about the last days, what will happen to Mexicans, and including the fact that restoration will have to be made to America's native peoples, including the restoration of land and the restoration of sovereignty. So there are all these promises. he never mentions the word Mormon in the entire book.
Right.
You know, he doesn't want to put people off for whatever prejudices they have. He wants them to see a better future in what he's saying.
Yeah, yeah, I was struck by how much, you know, you mentioned this early in the book, kind of, and the end again, you know, he's in some ways like a precursor of, you know, other important Chicano luminaries like Cesar Chavez and Reyes Tijerina Lopez, right? Or
right.
Lopez Tijerina, my bad, I got that reversed. And a lot, I mean, a key part of this was, you know, self-determination, casting off, again, colonialism. It's just, I mean, it's fascinating how, as you mentioned, I mean, the title, The Spiritual Evolution, and how a complicated figure was able to bring all this together.
Well, he thought long and hard about it. It's a family thing. I mean, his father fought for the Zapatistas. He was a spy in his 70s. You know, Margarito's constantly trying to do his religious thing to bring about the redemption of Mexico. It's interesting because I got an email from his grandson yesterday, who is a distinguished professor of medicine at the UCLA School of Public Health. And he was talking about, in light of what happened in the Capitol building, that a better day was coming for Latinos. And he was talking about the history of how Latinos had been active in the United States in supporting the country and fighting in the armed forces, all kinds of things like this. One thing I came to realize as I was writing this is that I think that in a lot of ways, Euro-Americans see Salvation Church differently than Latinos do. And for Latinos, I was reading, what was En La Lucha? You know this book? It's on feminist theology. And Maria Isasi Diaz. And she talks about how to be in a relationship with God means that you are serving other people. Otherwise, you don't have a relationship. You're invested in your community. So for Bautista, redemption of Mexico is his redemption. And there's this whole history of social activism in churches in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Robert Chao Romero has a book out called Brown Church right now, talking about the history of social activism over five centuries in Latino religion. I just attended a session on it at the AAR. But this is a real thing. Community, redemption of the community, serving your neighbor. Whereas I think oftentimes in Euro-American religions, they see a responsibility for to offer charitable services and help other people, but salvation is something you work out on your own.
No, definitely. And I appreciate you mentioning Robert's book. If he's listening, Robert, I'm going to be reaching out to you soon. I just got a copy of that book. And I mean, there's really a budding scholarship on these themes and on these issues about, you know, religion in the borderlands and its connection with social activism, as you're saying. And there's very much that very incredibly strong theme throughout this book. And maybe that can help us as we wrap up to talk about, you know, his legacy and particularly his kind of divergent and fraught legacy with Mexican-American Mormons and European-American Mormons. I mean, how is he remembered? And if he is at all, what's his legacy and impact?
It depends on how much people know about him. You know, for a lot of people, they have seen him as a pariah. But for people who remember him in the Latino community, there are some who they may not say it out loud, but they remember him with pride because he never bowed, right, to paternalism. So that part of his legacy is interesting. His colony still stands. In the United States, if you have a convention, what do you call it, intentional community, it usually lasts about 18 months max. But his colony is still standing today. It was, you know, he died in 1961. It was founded in the mid-1940s. So this is quite a legacy to have an intentional community stand this long. It's quite amazing, actually. About 60 years, right? So 60 years, actually. So that is something he is remembered by. I hope that his writings can be rediscovered because they do say so much. It's a Mormon chapter, a Mormon lens on these kind of tensions in the borderland. I think what it helps people say is nobody needs to say, oh, our religion has failed because we have tension, we have racial tensions. It's another thing to just say, hey, this happens everywhere. How do we work it out?
Indeed. As we address these issues in the classroom, oftentimes, I mean, students ask me several questions of, you know, how we make sense of the tensions in the different, institutions, organizations, or spaces that we exist. And one of the things I bring up is what you just said, right? I mean, there's always tension.
Yeah.
You know, we can't excise ourselves from every institution, every space, every relationship that is fraught with disagreement or with a difficult past, et cetera, right? So, I mean, there's so much truth behind that. And it's really fascinating. I mean, how about also, we kind of touched on this at the beginning, the significance beyond, we've already been touching on like significance beyond Mormonism with this kind of like fraught histories and tensions in all sorts of religious, but how about the significance of this work to, you know, the way Christian churches operate today? I mean, evangelicalism is, I believe, right, is still, you know, it grows incredibly fast throughout the world, particularly South America, particularly, I mean, the Mormon Church's growth in Africa has, you know, been, I don't know the right word, you know, to put on it, but it's been immense. It's basically growing exponentially. And this is, again, just part of a kind of like larger history that's continuing to develop, right? So this the whole, you know, Christian evangelization efforts throughout the global South has not stopped. It's a continued thing. And so what, you know, significance and lessons are to be, you know, drawn from this history that with all of its current relevance today?
Well, they have a lot more. There used to be that Mexico was one mission. Now it's many. And about, I think maybe 14 missions there. And I think about, or more. But half the mission presidents have Latino surnames. I don't know if that means they're Argentinians or Spaniards or Mexicans or Guatemalans, because they bring, you never are a mission president where you live. You get sent somewhere. That's what makes it a mission. Mm-hmm. So in the Mormon church. But I do think that indigenous leadership, persons of color, are being promoted more in leadership and churches. Even the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints now has a man of Asian heritage as an apostle. So I think that things are changing and they're growing. I think that's very important. Also because, you know, it's not just Mormonism that has grown in Africa. Christianity itself is growing in Latin America and Africa. And that's largely due to Pentecostalism. Now,
right.
Pentecostalism, and in lots of Protestant churches, entrepreneurialism goes on. You can just break off and create another church and people go, hooray, another Protestant church, another Pentecostal church. But when you have a centralized church, like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or the Catholic Church, then you run into issues about, do the leaders relate to me and my part of the world? Do they understand my culture? Do they understand my history? It's very interesting to me because in the pages, in the narratives of the Book of Mormon themselves, you have this very interesting narrative about a king named Mosiah that has two refugee groups come to him and ask for asylum or ask for refuge. And one of the first thing he does is have the history of those two people read out to his own, so they will understand their struggles and where they came from. I don't think it's a thing that happens in the United States or in churches, but I think it would be a great thing. And that's kind of what I'm hoping my book does for other people. I'm hoping, I tried to build a bridge really hard between Euro-American scholars, members of Euro-American churches, between Euro-Americans and the Latinx religious experience. I tried really hard because I think that what we have to do in the world right now on many levels is to listen to understand.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for coming on to New Books in Latino Studies and discussing your book. It's been loads of fun, and I learned so much.
Oh, you're kind. You were a great host. Thank you so much for having me here. I really enjoyed being here. And thank you to all the listeners who are listening. Oxford has told me I can give out a book coupon code for 30% off my book. If you have a pencil, you can write this down. It's AAFLYG6. I'll say it one more time. AAFLYG6. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for having me, DJ.